The following is Scott Thomas's keynote, Building the World's Visual Language, from the 2013 Information Architecture Summit. The 2013 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
Thanks for having me. Kevin, thanks for inviting me to speak at IA Summit. It's great to be here. Thanks to all of you for showing up. So, to begin, my name is Scott Thomas, but you can find me at Simple Scott. A lot of people ask me, why Simple Scott? What's the reasoning behind that? And it's actually, if I use my real name, Scott Thomas, I would run into some Google image search results problems with Kristen Scott Thomas. You don't want to compete with her. So it works out because my focus is to simplify things. I always think that there's a better way. I know that there's always a way that it could be a little bit more minimal. It could be a little bit easier. I think that a lot of people in this room probably share that same sentiment with whatever projects they're working on. But I'm also aware that this is a constant practice, and I'm never going to be completed with my work. I think we have to face it, though. The world is actually a really complex system, right? And it's in our DNA to basically replicate this pattern. We do it over and over and over again, which is why we often find ourselves in these environments that kind of look like this from Hoarders. Our environments quickly become cluttered, right? Unorganized, and yearning to be made sense of. Luckily, along the way, throughout our history, we've had really intelligent individuals, like a lot of the people in this room, who've helped us to make sense of this complexity by developing systems to unpack, organize, order all that knowledge that we've acquired. We created religion to answer these kind of unknown questions. We developed the sciences to organize our knowledge. And we perfected communication to share our thoughts and ideas. Throughout history, the effects of our inventions, though, are rarely understood in the plight of our causality. Take, for example, the development of the printing press, right? This thing gets invented, and it yields an entire age of enlightenment, seeding the ideas of democracy, where reason could actually trump those divine rights of lords and kings. The discovery of the steam engine fueled the growth of the Industrial Revolution, all of a sudden exponentially increasing the power of a single individual to carry a payload across great distances. And the manufacturing of the automobile ushered in mass production, building a life that only kings and lords could relish but a few centuries earlier. Each step in our human evolution has led to innovation, which is always intended to improve the quality of life and the balance for equality. So it really begs the question, and a question that's been asked probably over and over in this conference: what great movements are at the starting line, and what age is currently upon us? To think about that, I want to actually rewind to 2007. It seems like that was just yesterday, but it's now 5 years ago. 5 years has gone past. What was the situation like 5 years ago? Well, Conan was still the host of Late Night. And I don't know about you guys, but if Conan were still the host of Late Night, I would be a very happy man. So maybe I should live in 2007 forever. I don't know. But on the other side of things, Nokia was kind of leading the smartphone race, which is a little scary. 2007, Apple releases the iPhone. Google released the beta version of Android. I think we all know how that played out, right? Another interesting note is that one in every six Americans were actually connected on Facebook. One out of six, which you think, oh, that's pretty good for a startup. Like this guy, though, I think many thought that in 2007 that Facebook was really only for the young post-college crowd, right? It's not for these burger-flipping, unemployed high school dropouts. This is actually from TechCrunch, and it was the post in 2006 that was announcing that Facebook was going to lift the restriction and let anybody have an account. And this guy, I think, was a little wrong, right? I think Albert might have been a little wrong, assuming that 10 million people is a gross exaggeration. Well, I think this chart says otherwise. As a global culture, right, we were beginning to connect to one another at breakneck speeds. It would seem that this kind of major technological breakthrough probably was going to coincide some sort of social political upheaval. So it's probably no surprise that in 2007, this guy was president. This guy was running a campaign for change. And for the first time, a politician used not necessarily just the benefits of technology, but the benefits of social communication, the new social media, to empower the people once again. This was a campaign that spoke of we rather than he. It was up to us to put our money where our mouth was, and we did it in big numbers. And within the United States, many would say we were once again hopeful for a new day. We had this opportunity to perfect our union. And I think that the moment Obama took office, the world actually took notice. I believe that it was actually the catalyst and a groundswell of innovations and revolutions in how we communicate, really simply. There were probably many other things that were going on, but all of a sudden, I mean, you could say, well, wasn't the internet already around? The universe that we called the internet had already reached its critical mass. So why was it Obama that all of a sudden made this giant change in communication? I think it might have been the realization that social media could actually be used for something more than sharing photos of ourselves aging, right? Maybe it was the true hero. It was the one that was winning out. And for some people, this sounds like some sort of utopian ideal. We're all connected. But for others, it frightens us a little bit, that there's some kind of society of scrupulous scrutiny watching in on everything that we're doing. And this probably echoes a lot that you've been hearing throughout the week. Looking back on it, social media is clearly causing kind of a tear in our social fabric. In the last 4 years, the planet has watched the Arab Spring. We've watched protesters occupy Wall Street. We've watched authoritarian wiki, basically, that has sprung a leak. And we've seen markets collapse, where the few maintain royal rewards, while at the same time watching the rise of a crowd that is beginning to fund the products and innovations that we look for in the world. So it's not news that we're watching one medium die while giving birth to a new one. It's a grim reality that news is no longer delivered over the front page, but rather a web page. And rather than being delivered by an institution, it's being delivered by our friends and family. No matter your perspective, the landmark expression of every person's experience on Earth will undoubtedly lead to a much more vivid picture of our story towards progress. We're certainly closer to being connected by what McLuhan prophesized would be a global village. But with all this innovation and technology, we are still way behind on one key part of our globally connected society. We lack any development in the thing that actually separates us most, our language systems. Epitomized by this image, we have no idea what this individual is actually trying to say, right? Without a knowledge of Arabic, which I'm sure many of us don't have. We might be able to read the word Facebook, but the core of his message is cryptic to us. Luckily, the individual surrounding him make use of a universal symbol for peace. 17,000 years ago, humans communicated through pictorial form, through drawing representations. They were able to share their experience of life, time with friends, hunting, wars, feast, famine. Over time, that picture-based representation morphed into something known as ideographic representation, kind of epitomized by this image, right? This is actually the Chinese character for tree. Next to it, the pictogram for tree. You can see certain similarities there, right? And then next to that, you see the Chinese word for forest. Interesting how the semantics are baked right into the ideographic representation. this diagram, you can really see the evolution of ideographic form. Simple drawings, over time, made more and more complex in order to just represent the idea. But ideographic writing wasn't without its flaws, right? As new concepts emerged, the number of characters also had to escalate, creating a divide in people. People with really large vocabularies and people with really small vocabularies. It actually created a class system, those that could read it and those that couldn't read it. And this happened throughout history over and over again. But writing systems, they began to listen. They began to listen to the syllables of the spoken word. In Japan, men learned to read and write, while women were left out. So maybe it was out of a fit of rage that they began simply listening to the words and created an entire set of characters based off of syllables. It's called hiragana. This form of writing is known as syllabic. Though syllabic writing decreases the number of characters one has to remember, it greatly increases the number of characters one needs to write. Interestingly, in Japan today, hiragana is often mixed with kanji. It's almost like this sort of shortcut, if you will. Cue the next innovation in writing, phonetic. Thanks to the Phoenicians, furthered by the Greeks, later adapted by the Romans, here we completely untied the character from any semantic meaning at all. The T doesn't mean anything, the R doesn't mean anything, it doesn't relate to a syllable. It's the combination of those characters, of those individual characters together, that form a word, which then sparks the idea in our head. So throughout our history, we've had but four major innovations in writing. Pictographic, ideographic, syllabic, and phonetic. It's probably interesting that in time, this has essentially defined our borders. It's created our cultures and the people that we share a common understanding. But as the world shrinks and our cultures begin to collide, we actually need a system for communication that transcends borders, that delivers information clearly and concisely, and can even communicate abstract concepts. It would seem that the primitive form of the visual language is actually becoming more important to us. We've come full circle. As our world shrinks, globalization is starting to have its effect, and it's quickly beginning to erase a lot of those borders. This happened a couple times in other moments in history. As an example, Gerd Arts, Otto Neurath, were developing isotype to help teach children how to learn. They figured that if they actually used these sort of pictorial representations, children would have an easier time learning, especially visual learners. And this is about the time of World War II. But they furthered it by using their language to help communicate what was actually happening in the world. By combining symbols with quantitative data, they became the kind of early pioneers of infographics. And with World War II taking over Europe, they could use this method to communicate to a continent of people that spoke completely different languages. Another example, 1974. Our world begins to shrink again. All of a sudden, air transportation is on the rise globally. The AIGA, US Department of Transportation, created a set of symbols to simplify the international traveler's woes. You see, our visual language simplifies the most basic element of being human: communication to arrive at a common understanding. It's no wonder our world is full of these symbols. But with all of our advancements in technology, our visual language has had no reference, no single reference. There is no place that you could go. The verbal language has been organized by dictionaries, but the visual language? Completely underserved. No single place for this. This was really our motivation for creating the Noun Project. It's a visual library of symbols and icons, and it's been our mission to share, collect, and enhance this world's language.
In the beginning, humans created symbols. Symbols that explained their world, recorded history, and stood the test of time. Then we created languages and things got complicated. Many words, one symbol. Symbols have shared culture and spurred innovation. They've helped us understand the universe and make our planet a better place. The Noun Project community is building a global visual language that is helping to unite the world. A language understood in New York, in Tokyo, Bangladesh, in Brazil. A language that allows quick and easy communication no matter who you are or where you are. A language that connects people and saves lives. A language that encourages progress and inspires hope and equality. We are building a silent language that speaks louder than words. A silent language visible to the world, one word, one symbol at a time. The Noun Project. Say something.
Okay, if you want me to. So in a short amount of time, actually about 2 years, the project has become kind of a valued resource by designers, architects, artists, educators, with applications ranging from helping children to learn, similar to Otto Neurath and Gerd Arnst, all the way to helping execs make better PowerPoint presentations. We didn't get here out of thin air, though. We had to start somewhere. And oftentimes, when we're building a project, that's always the first problem. Well, how are we going to get from point A to point B? Luckily, there was already a lot out there that was free and available to the public. But no one had ever really sorted through all the sites, gathered them together in one place, and made it indexed and searchable. So we just went out, looked for all of those public domain symbols in the US alone, and we were able to conjure up a fairly decent collection. I think it was around 600 symbols is what we started with. Now we're over 20,000 symbols in our collection. And for the first time, you know, these symbols were now easy to find. They were on a convenient website that I could just go into the search bar and type what I was looking for, what I needed to communicate, and bam, download it, put it into my presentation. We knew in order for this collection to really grow, though, to get to the point that we're at today, we actually needed the help of the community. We needed talented designers all over the place. Guys like Adam Whitcroft from the UK, sharing symbols to basically help other people communicate. I love this wind symbol, actually. The other one, that just the lines that are kind of undulating, that's actually tornado. I think those are really wonderfully executed. Currently, the majority of our symbols are licensed under Creative Commons by attribution, allowing people to use the symbols for any purpose as long as they attribute the designer. We understood that attribution sometimes is difficult. People don't always do it. Oftentimes, it limits professionals who are wanting to use these in commercial projects. So we also decided to allow designers to enable their icons for purchase, so that way anyone could also kind of purchase a license. We actually call it an attribution waiver, which is just a technical term, but essentially you can use the icon without attributing the designer. One of the things that we found really fascinating about this project is that there's so many different ways to communicate or represent a single idea. But having a centralized system means that we can use the platform to ultimately be able to determine things like which icon is most used, which icon is most used in which country, which icon is most comprehensible. It's kind of fascinating to just watch the numbers. It's also interesting to watch what concepts get downloaded the most. Number one, can anyone guess what the number one concept is that's downloaded? No smoking? No. Restroom? I heard user. It's actually man. Yeah, man is number one. Can anyone guess what number two is? That's what I thought it would be, but it's not, unfortunately. I guess equality hasn't fully, we haven't gotten there yet. Home. Home is number two. Guess what's number three? Third most important thing in life. iPhone. Who knew? No, but it's kind of interesting. I mean, there's constantly new concepts to be illustrated. That was one of our favorite ones. Actually, that and Binder Full of Women, I think, were my two favorite from last year. There's also new ways to represent old ideas. Take the light bulb. The light bulb keeps changing form, right? I think this one's even out of date now. I think that there's even a new compact fluorescent or LED technology that's going to knock that one to make it old. As well as representations of ideas that are just make-believe. They're completely abstract notions, things that don't even exist in the real world that are illustrated, downloaded, and that allows us to tell our story. It allows us to continue our myths. But it's not all fun and games. Last year, we teamed up with the United Nations to release a set of humanitarian symbols in the public domain. It was a really great collaboration. Essentially, they had a bunch of ideas and they wanted a way to distribute them. They sent them over to our platform, we put them up, and now they can be downloaded. Really important things, like child combatant, which you can see in the upper left-hand corner. These are symbols that could be used in tragedy, in moments of a devastating earthquake. Similarly, we also host these things called iconathons. Iconathons are essentially design charrettes. It's kind of like a hackathon, but for design. And we get together to develop new symbols that could help solve problems. This photo is actually taken at the American Red Cross, the Global Disaster Preparedness Center. Preparedness is a really difficult word to say. We teamed up with them to create some icons, and it usually starts with just pen and paper, a note card. And we have several concepts that we work out before the event. So people come in the room, they're basically drawing icons. Really simple stuff, really, you know, crude sketches. I mean, some are less crude than others. But then we take all those ideas back, we team up with a couple designers that are there, and essentially we create these really great symbols. This is actually Skillshare. Oftentimes in disaster areas, they need some sort of knowledge exchange or some area to be able to share skills. Food shortage. Happens a lot. Search and rescue team. This was the kind of refined sketch we saw earlier. This is one of my favorite icons that we have on the project. It's just gorgeous. It uses the narrative form, right? It's not just saying search and rescue, but through the icon itself, it uses a narrative to tell us what this person does. And then the simple little hat with the Red Cross emblem on it communicates really, really well. What we found is by making these events open to the public, we get this really nice mix of people. People with different skill sets, different talents, and oftentimes, whether they're drawing or not, they're helping us kind of conceive of the symbol. And in a certain way, that dialogue that occurs between designers and non-designers really end up yielding great results. I think it's something that I've actually need to take into the rest of my practice as well. I realize that some of the greatest ideas do not happen inside the design studio. They do not happen at your desk. They happen through that exchange of ideas. Recently, I actually switched out my Facebook profile image to this human rights symbol just to communicate my support for marriage equality. But the collection isn't merely intended for the physical world, right? It's playing an increasingly important role in our digital world. Let's think about it for a second. Take out your phone and try interacting with it. It's almost impossible for us to not touch a symbol. Right from the start, you're probably going to have to touch an arrow. And then when you click in, there's probably going to be a screen that just contains a bunch of icons. There's a reason for that. This information's really, really dense. We can say a lot without a bunch of words. But oftentimes, we need to team these symbols up with words in order to communicate ideas. If you take this leaf, for example, and then team with a word like, we say leaf, right? That's the common thing to do. But it can represent something else. We could change that word out, and all of a sudden now that leaf is a mint leaf. We've just added a little bit more data to that leaf. It actually changes its semantic meaning. Do it again. Change the word out for hybrid. Symbols have been and will be an incredibly powerful tool in our communication. I really believe so. That's why I've been absolutely fortunate to not only help conceive this project, but work on it for 2 years. I don't think I'm ever going to get bored. With new concepts in medicine, technology, the humanities on the horizon, this language will finally have a home. So maybe we can actually begin to understand each other and potentially understand what it means that we're all connected. Thank you. Thank you. So I think we have some time for questions. I see Jared running, so I'll go over there.
It's me.
It's
you.
Hi.
That was awesome.
Thank
you. The Noun Project is awesome.
Thank you.
So my question is about the word good. For a while, when you search for good on the Noun Project, it was not there. There was no icon for good.
Sure.
And that was fine. But it's something that I'm particularly interested in because I've searched more recently, and my colleague Dan Klein brought up to my attention that there is now a result, and it is a person's face with a halo above it. So I was wondering if you could kind of comment on, not particularly that example,
yeah.
but just like, how are you going to ensure kind of cultural differences
yeah.
don't get lost in
yeah.
the creation of these things?
I think that's a really great question. Thanks for asking it. And actually, one of the things that is very, very true about our platform is we are somewhat, we don't care about the different kind of connotations of that word because that's only one way to describe it. And with the upload tool, you can upload your own interpretation of good if you would like. You know, that's kind of one of the nice things about it, is that it is open. And there are going to be certain representations that are just kind of off, because it is actually crowdsourced. We're using the community to help build this language. So as another interpretation of good gets uploaded, which you should probably draw with a friend, do it. For yes, awesome, just to draw good. Perfect. That's perfect. That's how these things happen. That's how these things happen. Good question. Over here.
Oh.
Over here.
Oh, okay. We're over here now.
I understand the simplicity of the project, but
yeah.
what about the complexity
oh,
of...
Oh, yeah. There's lots of spaghetti behind that one.
Of our loss of languages that most people have heard but will never, ever speak again.
Yeah. Really good question. I don't think that those are going to go away. And I actually am not really an advocate for saying that the symbol language is actually going to be one that's going to take over all language. I think that it just needs to be used in tandem with language. I think that it furthers understanding in a different way. So I don't think that it's going to completely rid ourselves of our tongues or our common language that we communicate in whatever nation we're in. I think that that's always going to exist, and I think that there's a place for that. All right, I think we got one over here.
Hi, I love your project. I use it all the time. Thank you. I'm curious your opinion on the emoji. So like a lot
yeah.
of the contexts you talk through are more designed or more sort of considered communication. So how are objects entering into our discourse?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question too. Thank you. Emoji is pretty interesting to us. And we actually have for quite a while thought about the reality that we should create an app and actually in some ways allow this to take even more presence in our everyday communications. So emoji is a great example of where these visual images are used and sent over text message, and we realize that we can probably build something that's very, very similar to that. So emoji has been interesting to us, but considering we have the platform to manage in itself, one of the realities that started surfacing this year is that we just need to release an API and really let anybody who wants to build off of our platform be able to do so. And so for us, the goal is to essentially open the platform up and create a service that allows anybody to use that in whatever way they want. If they want to include it into, you know, a tweet, or if you wanted to put it in your Facebook post, these are great social objects because they communicate in such a quick and effective way. Imagine streaming through your Facebook post and you see just simple images from the Noun Project. It's kind of this really quick and clear representation of what someone's doing or thinking, or you don't have to even think about words or take the right picture. So it's an interesting thing that you bring up, and we've definitely thought about other ways that people could use these as communication devices.
So the last time I went to the Noun Project, I absolutely love it, and it just makes my life so much easier. The last time I was there, I noticed that I now had to pay to get my icon. I was really bummed out. But so I was wondering
yep.
about like sort of the decision to monetize and
yep.
and when and where to monetize, but to keep that sort of, since it's crowdsourced, and keep
yep.
that sort of universality and walk that line.
Yeah. So first, you probably saw the buy button, and you missed that there's a download button right next to the buy button, because all of our symbols are still available for free, and you just have to attribute the designer. Now, one is light gray, so it almost looks like it's disabled, and the other one is black, and that was probably a variation that we've been testing to see which buy button works better. Oh, campaign days. So the collection is free. You can still use it. The thing that we've been finding in the way that we've been kind of going down our road to monetization is we do want the project to remain free and open for people to use. But we realize that for commercial purposes, people do want to buy these things. These are used in advertisements by ad agencies that have multi-million dollar contracts. So it makes sense for us to say, let's figure out a way to create a service that allows people to also have premium access to the collection. So if they want, they can download at will and essentially never have to worry about attribution, because I'm guilty of it, and I'm sure plenty of the other people in this room are guilty of not attributing when we're supposed to be attributing. And we realize that that's a problem and actually an opportunity area for us. Yeah.
Do you envision a need to extend and provide some kind of grammar rules for these symbols?
Give me an example.
In other words, do these symbols stand alone, or could you ever see a need for, like, you know, some kind of structure to
be able to,
put them together and exactly, and to add meaning through those kind of relationships? Have you thought about that?
We have, and it's been tried by different people throughout history. The Bliss symbol system was actually conceived basically to make it so that way people could communicate by symbols alone. It was really taken up by the autistic community and used a lot to teach autistic children just basic things that otherwise, if they were trying to learn that stuff through written form, just would never be able to communicate with their parents and loved ones. We actually have never really had the ambitions to form that kind of language out of this. We do find it interesting that if you string together multiple symbols that it can have a sentence-like structure, but I would never imagine a day where you see, you know, a 20-character Facebook post with a bunch of icons, because the meaning would kind of maybe be meaningless. We wouldn't understand what it was saying. And so actually forming it as a true language, in the sense, is not really our goal. I think it complements language, and I think that that's kind of the key of what we're doing. Thanks for the question.
So I was interested in knowing about what the community currently looks like in terms of the global aspect of it. So what's the involvement from different parts of the world?
Yeah, it's actually really good. We actually have over 50% of our traffic comes from overseas, which is fantastic. And then in terms of contributions, we receive contributions scattered all over the map. So I'd say that there's a lot of people in Europe right now. There's a lot of people in the US. There are a couple areas that I don't think we're doing very well in at the moment. We're not doing very well in China. I don't think we're blocked through their firewall, but we're not making any headway in China for some reason. And we're not making a whole lot of progress in like Brazil or Africa. But I think that's just because in a couple of those areas, Africa specifically, there's just not as much access to computers. So the moment where the access to computers actually increases and the access to the internet increases, I think we'll see quite a bit of public interest there. We do have hopes to create an ambassador program within the coming year to put people on the ground, essentially, in various regions, so that way the collection is becoming more robust globally. Because I think that is a problem where I'm based in Chicago, my co-founders are based in Los Angeles, and sometimes I think we feel way too American-centric. So I think there are times where we want to kind of expand it further and get more of a global reach. Thanks for the question. Way over here. Yes.
Hey, Scott. I'm Dan Brown.
Hi, Dan.
I'm familiar with mistaken identity. I'm curious, just to get pragmatic on us, you had mentioned iconathons.
Yeah.
We love collaborative brainstorming techniques. Can you talk a little bit about how you run those?
Yeah.
So if we were to try it tomorrow, we've got a framework that we can work from.
Sure. The format goes something like this. First, we actually walk through different ways to draw symbols and some of the fundamentals of drawing symbols. There's a small little tool chest, essentially. So we walk people through a presentation, and then we inspire people with whatever the organization is that we're working with to get that perspective of the organization. So we usually have those two parties speak first, and that's usually the first hour and a half of the session. And then we create basically these binders. We have a binder, and inside of it are concepts. And then we just lay out loads of post-it notes and Sharpies, and we let people kind of sketch these ideas and then place those post-it notes on the pieces of paper. So if there's a concept like good would be one piece of paper, and there usually would be a spot for anywhere between 4 and 6 post-it notes on that page. And then at the end, after the group has kind of worked through some of the ideas, we all get together and do a design critique. And it's really, really fun and really rewarding. We actually, though, just last week were talking about how great it would be to do silent voting as well, based off of which concept they thought was best. just so that way we could also get a little bit of like a flashcard sort of system, so that way when people are participating in these iconathons, you can also get a sense of user comprehension. How is this symbol being interpreted, and which one is being interpreted best, which would also be a really fun metric to maybe put in the mix if you're going to host your iconathon tomorrow. Yes.
Hey, Scott. So one of the first words I entered when I encountered the Noun Project was the word penis.
Oh, you entered the penis.
Yeah, and so it's because...
Okay.
Because I'm basically a big child, so... The real question is, it does not appear. There is.
Did somebody deny your penis?
Yes, basically. It's a long-standing problem.
It is.
I'm so sorry.
I'm done. Oh, that was great.
The real question is this: what is the editorial process like on the Noun Project?
Great.
So how do you go about deciding what will show up and what
So
will
we actually have a two-tiered editorial process, mainly due to the fact that we have certain technical guidelines that we're trying to run with the Noun Project. So we first run it through, is this symbol technically right? And then does it meet kind of design guidelines? So does it communicate an idea effectively? And if it does, we typically accept it. Note that because, and this has been an issue that's been debated within the Noun Project quite a bit, is a couple sensitive things like penis, how many penises do we possibly get? And then do we become the penis drawing website where people are just uploading penises all the time? I think, you know, it's a fine line. We have lots of concepts for bicycles or for, you know, user, and we want those kind of symbols and we want to further that kind of discussion. I think it's a really good question that you bring up. And typically after that first tier, we get to a second tier, and that's actually a little bit more refined. And usually people get back to you with the deny message that says, you know, the reason why that symbol was denied. You can log into your dashboard usually and see that message. And notifications will be coming really soon, hopefully in the next couple of months. So that way you'll actually get a notification in your inbox that says, hey, your symbol was denied for this reason. That was amazing. I've never had that happen before.
Hi, thanks. I'm from the Chicago area, Obama proud, so
all right.
Thank you for that. I actually had sort of a comment and question about an earlier question and your response to that. My family is from West Africa, and I have some knowledge of sort of the penetration of internet there for that.
Yeah.
And most of it is that they may not have computers such as laptops or tablets and such like that, but they would have things like feature phones or dumb phones there for that, which technically is still a computer there.
Yep.
And somewhat in there. Is there anything that the Noun Project is looking at in terms of being able then to achieve penetration into the developing world by expanding access through using something such as a dumb phone or feature phone?
Yep, definitely in our roadmap, and it has definitely been planned for quite a while, creating a mobile version for this. I think right now, the first phase of this project was to say, let's get a really large user base, and let's try and perfect the features of distributing these icons in an effective manner, first via desktop, because that's where most of our users are actually going, and then in time, start thinking about how this can actually be used on a mobile phone, or how you can participate with it on a mobile phone. So that is definitely in the roadmap.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks.
Let's give Scott a round of applause.
The IA Summit podcast are sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS13. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcast at library.iasummit.org.